Rodriguez-Tipas. We are your hosts. I am Joe.
And I'm Randy.
And this is episode 25 of our podcast, and the date is February 24th, 2021.
Dude.
And guess what today also is?
Yes. It's essentially an anniversary, brother.
Yeah, yeah. I didn't get you a ring.
Oh, I was counting on that.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it would be like 1 year. February 26, 2020, I checked the notes, was our 0th episode.
Yeah.
And so we are roughly a year in. I hope to have 52 episodes next this coming year, though.
Right.
That's what I want.
We're still sucking wind on listeners, but, you know, that hopefully will improve with time.
We'll push. We got a superstar guest today, though.
Yeah.
So that's going to push the numbers up.
Yeah.
So anyway.
He's going to double our numbers just from appearing here.
Glenn, the man, Halstrom, Radio Grognard, welcome.
Hi, are you guys doing the show? I could do a show. I've been on the internet before.
Oh, and we were really hoping to catch Glenn drunk. That's great. Yeah.
Hi, folks.
Yeah. So, Glenn, just tell our folks, this is personal interest of mine. I heard you mention that you started gaming with Gamma World. Is that true?
Almost.
Okay.
Okay. I had to sit down and think about this recently. When did I start gaming? I knew I kind of, but I had to like backtrack into like the past two marriages and all this other stuff in my life. And I figured I started around 1980.
Okay.
Which gives me some cred, I think.
That's about when we started.
Yeah.
Here's how it went down. I spent a little time in Chicago at one time after I got married, and then I moved back to California. Before I moved back.
I'm sorry on both counts.
Oh, hey. don't you diss California, man.
Diss
Chicago all you want. But anyway, I'm trying to make a long story short here, but a friend of mine bought what I found out later was the Holmes box set, which was out at the time. And we all went over to his house and looked through the box, and we didn't know what the heck this was all about. And
yeah.
He was making fun of the names of the gods and all this other stuff. And it's like, I forgot all about it. Because I read something in the Chicago Tribune about this thing called Dungeons & Dragons. Didn't really click. When I got to, we ended up back in California. My wife, we were in the Bay Area. My wife was going to San Jose Community College.
Mm-hmm.
And she said one day, hey, I found a bunch of people at the student union who play this game. You want to try it? I said, sure. And the rest is history. Now, the first DM I had was this girl and her brother, who also played in the game. But she ran the game, and she started us with AD&D First Edition.
Okay.
And I played it. We played it for like maybe 3-4 sessions. And all of a sudden, okay, we're playing Gamma World because that's the game she really wanted to play.
Okay.
We spent like 3-4 years in Gamma World, and it really made me dislike post-apocalyptic games. Now I love them because I know how to do them. But back then it was like, I guess you could call it a sandbox if she had anything planned for us to do.
Oh.
We spent a lot of time wandering around, fighting the occasional monster, wandering around. You know, does this do anything? I almost got out of gaming.
Really? It was that bad, huh?
It was boring.
Yeah.
Until somebody gave her, for her birthday, a copy of Second Edition Champions, which was the hot new game. And I looked at it. I borrowed it, and I looked at it, and I immediately made 35 characters.
35
because it's like, wow, I can do anything with this.
That's some time though, ain't it? 35 champion characters.
Yeah, but once I got rolling, you know,
yeah,
just sort of like it. Just I want a guy who can do this. I want a guy who can do that. What's the weirdest thing I can do with this? You know, that kind of thing. And you know, I made one guy. All he does is point at stuff and it explodes. That's it. You know.
Yeah.
And so I played Champions for like 12 years, mixed occasionally in with Warhammer Fantasy Roleplay with this other group I had found.
Yeah.
And that was like the golden age to me.
Okay. So you weren't really playing D&D for that time, just Warhammer?
Not really.
Oh, interesting.
We even tried GURPS Fantasy for a little while, but Okay, and then I played with them, and one day, here's something that's funny. So if I bar you guys at these, you can edit this, right? Okay. No, it's not bad. It's just long.
Go ahead.
We can edit it in post if we need to.
Yeah.
Joe's got
fix
steel.
It in post, just like Orson Welles. Fix it in post. no, I played for 12 years until one day, and this is after I got divorced. I had a girlfriend, and she played and all this other stuff. One day, we had a guy GMing Champions, okay? And my friend made this character who fights with his cloak. He's got weights on his cloak and stuff, and he'd do all this fancy martial maneuvers and all this other stuff. And there was a scenario about he found us. There is something going down there, some kind of thing, and he saw a sniper up on the roof of a building. So he went up there, and with his stealthy skills, he snuck up behind him. He says, "What?" And the GM says, "What are you going to do?" And he says, "Well, I'm going to take one of my weights off my cloak and knock him out, bash him over the head."
Mm-hmm.
The first thing out of that GM's mouth, "Well, did you buy it like that?" "No." "Well, then you can't do it." And I heard this, and I watched them go back and forth about this, and it's like, no, I want something simpler. No, I'm screw you. I'm going back to D&D.
Yeah. You know, I think that's an interesting statement, Glenn, because at this point in my life, I'm attracted to simple. And if you've listened, we talked with you and Eric that one time. Joe and I are both looking back at old school. He's not so much into simple, but he's kind of tired of some of the modern stuff. I don't want to speak for you, Joe. That's just my opinion. But I like simple. And I don't know if D&D's, especially AD&D.
OSR for life.
Right. I don't know if AD&D's ever been simple, honestly, if you play by all the rules or second edition, all the rules. But
well, that's the first thing you learn in old school.
No one does it.
You don't follow all the rules.
Right. No one
does.
Do
what you want.
Grappling rules.
But you know, the hero games and champions, players and GMs and stuff, they are so anal about it because you have to pay points for everything.
Yep.
So, and there's, I think they're so worried about people are going to abuse it or something like that. And there's always the, what we call the nuclear escalation of, you know, that kind of thing getting tougher and tougher.
I have to chime in on Champions because I played that for a while when I was in the military.
I still love it.
And I can't remember what edition it was when I did this, but I made a character that all they did was they made you blind and deaf. Because it's a cheap power.
Right.
And it's easy to make people blind and deaf. And then everybody else is the cleanup.
Right.
You're blind, you're deaf. You're blind, you're deaf. You make them high on agility so that they can speed, maybe speed, where you get the multiple attacks and stuff like that. You have fast attack track.
Right.
And flash, that's what it is. Flashing is the senses. You flash your vision, flash your hearing. And I was like, oh, I just broke it, I think.
Go ahead.
There's that and the Paste Pot Pete kind of character where you just throw a pot of glue on somebody and they can be super powerful.
I understand. And I think I think the hero system is great.
Yeah.
For a player.
Right.
For a GM, I'm too old. It tires me out.
Well, don't you think games like Hero System, GURPS, that are full point buy, where you build everything from the ground up, there's no way even the designers can realize the deviousness of players. And I say that as a compliment.
I mean, you know, I'm thinking D&D players are already devious. Can you imagine these guys?
Yeah, I know. I do think Savage Worlds does a good job of that.
I think it does a great job.
As far as a generic system, I would say Joe agrees with me. It's probably the best.
I also like Mutants and Masterminds because I looked at it and I went, you know what? This is like Champions for dummies.
Well, if you don't want to spend all day making a character, trying to turn every knob, dial it up to 11 on everything.
When it first came out, I was telling Randy how much I liked it.
Oh, yeah. You were in D.C. Weren't you in D.C. when it first came out? And you're you got to get this game.
Yeah. So now Gage would go, I wish we could play Champions again. I could go, How about Marvel? How about Guardians? How about
Marvel
Super, the original face rip. Marvel.
What was Guardians?
That is Night Owl Workshop. They did a whole bunch of games where they said, well, what if Gary and Dave were inspired by this? And they made one for pirates. They did one for supers. They did one for John Carter-esque stories. They did in pulp Indiana Jones. And they just took White Box and tweaked it into that.
Oh, that's cool. That's
and cool. I played Guardians with Eric Bloat. No, not Eric Bloat. I'm sorry. Eric Webb. Over in the Austin group, the Royal Dragoons, and we played one of those. I had a ball. That system is really nice. But anything that'll make it easier. I was it 3 years ago? Theron Bretz ran a fourth edition champions game. Fourth edition, big blue book. I love that book.
Yeah.
He ran a fourth edition champions game, and I sat right next to him. And the other side was my buddy Steve. And I watched him, and it just came flashing back to me. I watched him. He said after he ran that game, he had to go up to the hotel room and take a nap. Because I watched him juggling papers and rolling dice and juggling more papers and looking stuff up. Because you got to remember, even in D&D, but worse than Champions, you've got one character you custom built right there. He's got like five or six he has to juggle. And it's not like you have... you know, goblin A through C or D or F with the same stats. No, these are all totally different.
Yeah, mm-hmm. You have the Brotherhood of Evil Mutants in front of you. You got Magneto, you got Toad, you got all those guys. Like, it's super hard to manage.
Oh, my God, I remember how hard this was. And the guy, I spent 12 years playing Champions because our DM was really good at it.
Yeah.
So I dodged a bullet, I think.
On to a slightly different question. On your on your podcast, you talk about different games you're into. And are you playing a remote game with people in New York? Did I hear that right?
Yes.
And how is that going?
Long Island, New York. It is going all right. We're using the software called House Party.
I've heard of that.
And when I started, it was just them around the DM's house at the table on Long Island, and I was just house partied in. But now a couple of people got COVID, so we're all doing it remotely. It's a 1E game.
And you run a game yourself, because you have another group?
I do not at this time. No. I have run for them, but it was face to face. I'm trying to get my feet wet into the online stuff.
Yeah.
I found a VTT that I can handle now.
Is that the Owlbear one you were talking about?
Yeah, Owlbear Rodeo.
I want to check that out.
Folks, try it. Owlbear Rodeo, really great stripped down VTT. Because, you know, we run on Roll20 on Mondays. My friend Carlos runs it. And, Gage, when he was here, he would explain three times. And I go, yeah, I kind of got it. but Owlbear Rodeo is so much easier. And, the only thing it doesn't have is the voice like this. And we can run Discord.
Sure.
For it.
Yeah, that's cool. Now, about cons, I have a question, because I just recently listened to part of Thaco's Hammer, which is one of Glenn's other podcasts. And you guys mentioned, I thought you said
I was going to play ignorance about having a schedule, but then I found, I do Thaco's Hammer, don't I?
Well, you mentioned that you weren't going to North Texas Con, but that's not set in stone, you said? Before we got on here, you were talking about maybe you might go.
I want to go. I want to go very badly. I didn't go last year because of COVID.
Right.
They still had it.
Yeah, they did. They met face to face. I've heard.
But they also had it virtually, too. And to me, I don't do virtual cons. I think it's kind of an oxymoron.
I
can get a game online anytime I want.
Yeah.
So what's the, virtual Gen Con, virtual Gary Con?
Yeah, I think they're finding. Yeah. I think that's happening. I think I'd heard on Tinker's show he had talked about how the they're dwindling a little bit. I think people are getting burnt out on the virtual stuff. I know I don't care for it. Yeah. I've only done a little bit of it.
I think there was like 75 people in the actual hotel last year, and everybody else was online.
Now, have you been to Gary Con too? Because I know North Texas.
I only get one con a year.
Oh, okay. I was just wondering.
The wife says I get one con a year.
Just one. All right.
Hey, with our finances, that's why I get roommates.
Right. Gotcha. Gotcha.
I'm not even going to try for a roommate this year because, like, COVID, who's, you know, I probably won't get anybody. Anyway.
True.
Cool. I've got a question.
What?
I was listening to a podcast of dubious repute, and in it, mine. These people, they were saying, in their opinion, making an RPG, and not just making it from scratch, but maybe retooling like an OSR game, was harder than making a movie. And I was
did you say making or retooling an RPG?
Retooling an RPG. I don't even think making an RPG is probably not nearly as complex as a movie.
I can't imagine.
I would agree with you.
Yeah. And I'm not into the industry like you are, but just thinking that you need sound, lighting, and actors, that's after you've gotten a script 5 or 6 different times, and maybe you have to have times. Producers and a director and funding and all this stuff. And
even for a small time movie, like somebody that's got a few thousand dollars,
like a micro budget indie movie or something.
Yeah. Right? It's gotta be more complicated than an RPG.
It is.
It has to be.
I mean, we say that it's more complicated than RPG, but then again, these people who are talking don't know RPGs. Mm-hmm. It's simple to us because we understand the mechanics.
Yeah.
Now this could be rocket science as far as they're concerned.
Well, no, these were was an RPG. It's a gamer podcast.
Oh, okay. Oh, wow. Okay. Wow. Sorry.
It's a gamer podcast. And but
I wouldn't say so.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I'm interested. You podcast every day, Glenn, and you tend to do 10-12 minutes depending on your mood, sometimes a little longer, sometimes maybe shorter.
By the way, I bumped your last message over to the next episode over.
Oh, dude, I love the cleric episode. That's why I called twice, dude.
Yeah, Jason called, so I put him on because he was shorter. I had something else I want to talk about.
That's cool. No big deal.
So I'm like 3 days ahead right now.
Right. Well, my question is, so now that you're doing that as a solo podcast, and you do Thaco's Hammer, I don't know if you guys have a monthly schedule or whatever.
We try to get it every other week, do it every other week, but, you know, it's trying to herd cats sometimes.
Yeah,
you know,
and then you're working with Eric Tinkar on Dungeons, Dragons, and Discord.
Yeah.
How is the experience comparatively, if you compare them? What do you think it's like working with people versus just doing your own little short thing every day?
I love working with people. In fact, I was in radio for a short time, and my main complaint was, or my main thing was, I need a partner. I need to bounce off of somebody.
Yeah.
Now, I do the daily thing. I started the daily thing just to keep my hand in, just to, you know, be – I just wanted visibility for myself.
Yeah. Gotcha.
Keep my hand in.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's okay. But Thaco's Hammer is great because I can bounce off other people. When we were doing when I was doing Save or Die, and even early Thaco's Hammer, I had people like Save or Die, I had Vince there who I'd say something, and he would, like – either play devil's advocate or call me out on it. And so I actually had to explain myself, which I greatly resented because I was but it gave more information.
Just accept what you say is truth, right?
Yeah.
Why are you arguing with me?
I have spoken.
Yeah. Well, it's not an even help. To me, it's more like I operate out of my gut a lot of the times. I don't have a reason for this. Because I feel it's right. That's why I do it. You know? So, but he would call me out, and it was great because it made great podcasting.
Gotcha.
So that's why I like people. I like people with me to bounce off.
Well, we're glad you're here. We're going to be, bouncing.
You know, when Vince left, he did not. When Mike took over, man, he did not listen to Vince because I said the number one rule with me is you got to learn to say shut up, Glenn.
Let me practice. Shut up, Glenn. Did that work? Oh, look at that,
Wow.
Wow. It's like magic.
It is. I wish I could work on Joe. I tell Joe to shut up, and he goes, you shut up. I'm not shutting up.
Nobody tells Joe what to do.
That's a truth. Hard-headed what is mother.
It's like having Pee Wee Herman on here. You shut up. No, you shut up.
All right. Well, let's – and, Glenn, you can chime in wherever you feel like it. We're going to jump to a little gaming news here.
Gaming news.
All right.
And, there we go.
You lay it on me, guys.
Did you notice?
Apparently, we've got news that I think I said I was uninteresting when you brought it up the first time.
I think you did, but yes. I think what I heard was, Randy, please do more of that. So I did.
Okay. And that is Call of Cthulhu is number two again.
Dude, no. Incorrect. You're looking at the wrong thing. So if you check this out now, Roll20, that's an updated one from last week. So according to Roll20 stats, 8 million users. First of all, uncategorized. I thought about this. I think what it means is there's no game connected they can identify. So it doesn't say Savage Worlds. Right. It doesn't say Vampire. And so what happened last week, we had talked about, Glenn, that on Roll20, of course, D&D is the king. You know, 5e is winning 5e. The battle. But Call of Cthulhu was strangely number two if you ignored the grouping of uncategorized. And now it's not. Notice that actually Pathfinder 1 is beating Pathfinder 2. And
of course it is.
And also on fantasy grounds, Pathfinder 1 is beating Pathfinder 2, followed by Savage Worlds, then COC. So Call of Cthulhu is not doing as well. I'm not trying to make a point against Call of Cthulhu. I'm sure this fluctuates if they're doing
it. I played it before. I loved the game.
Yeah. I'm just saying, I'm sure it fluctuates. I just thought it was interesting that Pathfinder 1 is actually winning the battle.
Very so nice. On the link that you gave me, and I clicked on there, mm-hmm. and it says Call of Cthulhu at 10.3%. And it's right underneath the uncategorized category.
Okay, hold on, give me a sec here, bud, because I think you're lying to me. I think you're telling me a story. I think
I'm going to refresh.
I'm going to
10.30%.
But that put them. Hold on a second. Maybe it's a live thing. You think it's a live thing?
I don't know.
Dude, come on. We are like doing this all in real time. Let's check this poop out.
Yeah.
Let's see. So when you hit this, I'm going to hit it too with my fist because I'm getting really mad that I'm wrong because I'm not supposed to ever be wrong.
Now.
Let's see. Call of Cthulhu's 10, but whoa, that's not the right one.
Okay, so that's campaign percentage.
Oh.
Then there's an account percentage.
Right.
So
that's what I was looking at.
Okay. So,
because it was only 6.5.
Systems with the biggest growth. So there's multiple graphs there. So I don't know the difference between what and what.
And I don't know what
Call of Cthulhu is number two after uncategorized, even in the account percentage. So.
Yeah. So it looks like, okay, so I guess I'm wrong. But the point was, I thought it was interesting. I was more intrigued by the Pathfinder thing, that one is beating two. But I guess that's because, well, they have people that they left behind when they made their new game. And
oh, that was a big stink, wasn't it?
I thought it was a bad move because I think one of the reasons we played Pathfinder is we still like third edition. We didn't want to go to something.
Well, I kept hoping it would drive more people to Castles and Crusades, which is the real 3E clone.
Hey, I don't know. Maybe.
I've never played that.
I don't like 3E.
I noticed that Castles and Crusades is. I've got the PDF of the 7th printing, and I like it. You can definitely tell it's got a lot of 3rd edition.
Oh yeah. They just cut out all the BS.
Pathfinder really was more like 3.75. It wasn't really like a brand new edition. It just cleaned up a few things.
But I keep telling, if you want to go from second to third, go over to Castles and Crusades.
Oh, you see. Oh, I would agree. That's a good bridge. I mean, if you like Castles
and Crusades. At the time it came out, they said it was the Rosetta Stone of D&D.
I remember. It was quite popular.
I missed that one.
Oh, did you? Yeah. it was popular initially. I think they've still got a pretty good following because they keep.
They do. Printing. They have an enormous following.
Yeah.
I wish I could play more of it. It has Bluffside, one of my favorite campaign places.
Okay, so what do you think the Castles and Crusades cuts out? That third edition.
Feats.
Feats. Oh, yeah.
Okay. Feats and things. I don't remember their proficiencies. I hate those.
You mean skills?
Skills,
No, I mean weapon proficiencies, not weapon proficiencies.
Oh, they cut that out from second edition because it was not in third.
Whatever the equivalent was in third. And they cut out things like, you know, prestige classes and stuff like that.
Wow.
They cut the fat out, basically.
No. Okay.
Yeah. I thought prestige classes were kind of annoying. I got to not like how the skill point allocation was way too fiddly for my taste.
Yeah.
And then the way that feats were done in that edition, you had clear, this is stupid, why would I ever choose this, to something like, wow, everybody's going to want that.
What fighter doesn't want power attack?
Yeah. Right. I like the primary system they have.
Yeah, I've seen it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Do you know what I'm talking about?
I do. Well, a little bit. Yeah, I know you have a primary. You
choose 6 stats. You choose 1 or if you're human. Yeah. Primaries, and it affects what your role is going to be on, like, those stat things or skills that
is it up is that. It whether you get to add your level or not. If it's primary,
you do get to add your level, but it's like primary you're rolling 12 or over.
Oh, that's right.
Changes and non-primary you're rolling 18 or old or
yeah.
Over.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, so in essence, if this is something you can do well, you roll your die, and if you get 12 or over, you're good. But if it's something that you don't have any training in,
yeah.
It's a stat,
you're better at strength than at dex. You're better con saves than, you know, charisma saves.
Yeah. I know when I first heard of prestige classes in third edition, I actually liked them because in the DMG, they sold them as something you could build to make your world unique.
That's true.
But they never worked out, Glenn. That was the problem.
Yeah.
If I made one that I thought was relatively balanced, well, the players hated it because it didn't give them the power up they were looking for. Yeah, not enough juice. I'm like, well, I don't want to just make you broken. But
the other thing is they were supposed to be specific, and they ended up making a bunch of generic ones.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. What I've seen in 5e is you don't really make any quote unquote prestige class or whatever the hell they go, but they drown you in classes and subclasses. Every new book has some new ones.
Well, and you will be picking a path that feels like a subclass. If you're a fighter, then you choose the Eldritch Knight, which used to be a prestige class.
Right, right. And so it just, to me, it's like too much. And Gage, God bless him, he's 17, so he's at that give me a lot of crunch stage. That's why he likes 5e.
Sure. But
very valuable. It's like, we're playing this game. I'm playing this character called Lojack.
Yeah.
And I said, and we're playing an Eberron.
Yeah.
And I took my character Lojack the Lumper from my novel and my comic strips, and I said, I'm going to play him. He's an adventurer, but he's more like a private detective.
Gotcha.
And so I go to Gage, I said, this is what the guys all like. And he says, okay, fine. You take this prestige, you take this class and this class. This is, thank you. Whenever I have to level up, I'm calling on you.
Has Gage ever played third edition or Pathfinder? Because you talk about
He said he
moving
was
parts, he would probably like it.
Actually, he said he was in a Pathfinder game, but I don't know if it's 1 or 2.
He could definitely.
He said he's on an online Pathfinder.
If he would play Pathfinder 1 with all the splat books, he could have all tinkered to his heart's desire.
The thing is, if you need, and you got to, I think, unless you just went to some, you had your things you liked and you always played those things in Pathfinder, it got to be where you kind of needed software to manage all of these things. Is the volume of choices D&D that
beyond.
You had. Yeah. And that's I like being able to have, I think even the game rules kind of, but I like having the, a game where I can have most of it in my head.
I can't imagine anybody playing Pathfinder 1 or 2 and having to deal with something like Roll 20 at the same time. That would drive me crazy.
Well, I think they have character sheets, which would help a little. And Joe did the, what was that, Hero Lab for a while.
Yeah.
It was kind of impressive, but like, I think Joe and I both, one of the reasons we're so into exploring the OSR now is because we do long for that day where we basically, I mean, even in the heyday of second edition, and Glenn, I had a metric butt ton of second edition stuff. And I save mostly, yeah, I save Ravenloft and I save all my Planescape stuff. That's what I have now. But dude, I knew that shit inside out. The monster manual, you kidding me? I could almost tell you the armor class, hit dice, and damage of the majority of the key monsters I would use. And I knew every monster you said. Mm-hmm. And I'm not bragging. I just played it a lot and I knew it. Yeah. And I think Joe's the same way. You talk about a wizard spell. Oh yeah, I know that. You know, and he would know how.
I roughly know that stuff.
Yeah.
But I could either approximate the exact rules for a character thing, a player thing.
Right.
And then back it up with the book if I had time to look for it.
But do you think it's just a function? Do you think it was just a function when I think about that, Joe and Glenn? I was a lot younger then, dude. I was like 14 to 18, 19.
Yeah, I take that into consideration.
Yeah, because I think I just remembered stuff and I absorbed things a lot faster. And we played a hell of a lot more.
I think that's the primary.
And that's, yeah.
Playing
that's
a lot
more.
Yeah. When you're young, like that's the one of the reasons why Gage wanted to play champion so much. Oh, look at all that crunch.
Yeah.
You know, that kind of thing.
I like a crunchy game. I think there's a amount for me that's too much, but.
Now, tomorrow night, I've actually got a face-to-face game.
Hmm.
I have one.
Very cool.
Matt Evans. I play with Matt Evans. He usually runs MythGarther.
Oh, hey, pronounce that. Can you spell that for me? I've heard you say it. Is it Myth?
MythGarther.
And it's a 5e type variant.
He based it on 5e, and he stripped all the junk out of it.
Huh.
And it's very tuned to his world of MythGarther, which is a flat Earth world, which is very. It's 5e with some Warhammer Fantasy roleplay thrown in there.
Is this something you can buy? Is it for
yes,
sale?
Yes, on DriveThruRPG, MythGarther Entertainment, and he has a website with MythGarther Entertainment. We're not playing that right now because I'm running.
Yeah. Okay.
And this is what I'm running him through right here.
Yes. That's something Joe and I are interested in.
Astonishing Swordsmen and Sorcerers of Hyperborea, Ghost Ship of the Desert Dunes.
That looks cool.
Yeah. Matt's big on Germanic Norse mythology type stuff.
Well, I'm big on the kind of fantasy a la John Carter of Mars and Conan and that kind of thing.
Yeah, this is right up your alley, man.
Yeah,
very cool.
It's like $70. I don't even know if he's trying to get another printing run going. But
yeah, I'm waiting for the new printing.
It's like $70
and extra money.
Yeah. I'm gonna check it out because
I bought my GM Carlos and one he ran some for a while. I was going to North Texas. I said, hey, you want me to pick up the player book? It's only $40 because the player book's only half of the regular book,
right?
The first three chapters. And he just gave me $70 as well. Why don't you just get the whole thing for me? Okay.
Very cool. Yeah.
Fine. Cool. And I got him that and a GM screen, and man, we just. And what's neat is it's only a 12 level cap.
Yeah.
Well, you know? I've seen the PDF, and it's it has, you can get experience beyond 12th level, but it doesn't have any additional character rules for beyond that.
Right. I would just, I figured 12th level is a good sweet spot to stop at and just start over.
Yeah.
Okay.
Uh-oh, Glenn. You're on Joe's bad side now, dude.
I don't get this starting over crap. Because it's always play a few levels, start over. Play a few levels, start over. Why can't?
Well, if it goes up to 12, if it went up to 20, yeah, go to 20 or 36 like basic does.
Yes. That's what I'm talking about, Joe.
But okay, like. Fine. But I'm saying it only goes up to 12 levels, so you got.
Yeah. But there seems to be a 9, 10, 11 kind of. Stopping point.
It's kind of popular now.
OSR. 13th age is OSR. 10. No matter, I think
this
that would
here,
be.
Yeah.
Gangbusters BX edition.
Yeah.
Stops at 5.
Yeah, 5th level.
Until he gets the expert book out, he's going to put another 5 levels in there.
Oh my.
Oh, okay. Well, that's cool.
Yeah.
So what? I can't imagine. See, in that kind of Gangbusters, that's 20s.
Yeah.
1920s style.
Prohibition.
Prohibition.
Gangsters.
I can't I can't imagine needing to have characters of a very high level in that, because I mean, you're normal people, right?
Yeah.
Essentially.
By the way, this game, not only this, but I've got the original Gangbusters. It really drove home the idea of what AC is to me.
Really?
Because I kept looking at Gangbusters and I'm thinking, he's doing regular AC. So we have people running around with I think it's descending AC. So we have people running around with ACs of zero.
How are they managing that?
And so I finally had to think about it, because AC is more than just the armor you wear.
Hmm.
I mean, these guys, I'm thinking, are quicker and faster.
Must be.
And, you know, you've got to take that into – a lot of people don't take that into consideration when you think of hit points in AC. Because hit points is supposed to be feinting, dodging, getting out of the way, taking a shot here, and then, you know, that kind of thing.
Right.
It's accumulation of a round.
Yeah.
So that really got me thinking about that, and I've been applying that to my D&D stuff, my other games.
Okay.
It's like, okay, he can be naked and still have an AC of 15.
Well, I mean, if you're willing to abstract it to that level, sure, because the idea is a tough dude's a tough dude.
I can't see any other way,
right?
You know, to justify that.
Yeah, sure.
So it's interesting.
What do you guys think? Did you guys get a chance to look at that Pericle RPG Kickstarter I talked about? Did you watch that little video?
I didn't watch the video, but I read the blurb and I thought about it a little bit. It's a DM-less, computer-guided system, which I think might be okay, but also might be a big pile of crap.
That's an interesting thing. One of our friends, Patrick, talked about this. Is that really an RPG? So what happens is the computer AI is your game master. One to four players work together in a board. I would call it a board game-like thing, but they have maps and minis. And similar to the – I don't know if you heard of the board game Pandemic, Glenn.
I've never played it, but I've heard of it.
It's a cooperative board game.
Yeah, I have.
It's a mixture of choose your own adventure path and video games, but it hit me like interactive type. You remember in 3E they released Scourge of Worlds? And, kind of weird, but you get battle maps and minis and all kinds of goodies, and it's kind of cool. Cost moderately high, not huge, $50-$60. And I thought, it sounds good, but it doesn't really sound like a freeform. It can't really be freeform.
There's no way.
The computer's giving you, they even say in the video, you get three or four choices here. And I'm like, I'm kind of playing a video game, but with the board game element. It might be kind of cool, but it's not really
a video game with extra physical products.
Oh, then you're playing 4E.
Except in this, there's an actual computer game. So,
we didn't say it this time. Glenn did.
Glenn did.
Oh, I'll say it all day.
4E's the suck. Yeah, yeah. No doubt.
Right. I remember when I pulled out, I got the 4E Player's Handbook, and I was looking at it, and it made me fall asleep.
It's like reading a.
Oh, it was just so repetitive.
Yeah.
Everybody had like 50 different powers, and they all looked the same.
And the flavor was gone. They just sucked it out of the game.
That's too bad. It became a tactical game at that point.
Now, what about the Ravenloft? You know, this disappointed the crap out of me. So they're got one of the cool new settings is Ravenloft. I like Ravenloft, but they kind of already done it.
Wizards of the Coast appropriating old stuff again.
Oh, cool. Well, it's technically theirs now, Glenn.
Well, I know. But what I've just heard the announcement today. I just saw it on Facebook.
Yeah. And
the first thing that was in my mind was, this better not be a demiplane.
Yep. Domains of Dread.
I don't want a demiplane. I want it originally the way it was in the original module, where it was part of like Greyhawk or something.
Right. You walked into the mists.
Yep.
No mists. You just stumble on it. That's what I'm saying. I don't want to go into another dimension.
No.
Mists were an I-6. They were in I-6, Glenn.
Yeah, the mists were there. It's not saying you're in another dimension.
Guarantee it.
Uh-uh.
Yeah, buddy. Yeah. No. But anyway,
And now they got the Hickman's back. They can put what's his name's domain back.
Well, yeah, they're going to do LaMordia, Barovia, Falkovnia, but they've changed things. But the thing that it sounds okay, but the problem is they're bringing in Dampier, Joe, and Reborn and Hexblood. But the point is, why are they doing this setting? They've already done the book. And that's kind of, I guess, because it's probably easy.
I played through Curse of Strahd.
Me too. It was pretty good. Yeah, the original was good. Curse of Strahd's a good read. It's a good module. It's probably the best 5e module there is. It's that
probably
good.
I mean, we followed that up with Tomb of Annihilation, but yeah, you're right.
Yeah.
So I played through that module.
The original?
I don't know if it was the original, but it was one of the I don't know if it was the third edition version. No, it was the original because he had the original module.
Yeah, yeah.
And we weren't first level, that's for sure.
No
and
way.
My character had somehow happened upon a ring of one wish. So the way we beat Strahd, because we accidentally took the Omega door and was right in his face really, really quick.
In the keep.
And so I wished him to no longer be a vampire.
And your DM lets you get away with it? That's pretty cool.
It did, because what it did was it completed. He was the being a vampire separated him from the girl. Can't remember her name. Tatiana.
Yeah.
And that's what he really wanted. So that let him have her. It didn't make him good.
No.
But he had her.
He had her, and he appreciated being able to have her, so he let us go.
That's a way to meet him.
When we played Curse of Strahd, we must have beat the crap out of him about three or four times.
Yeah.
Only because I felt that we were on our game, and we stayed on our game through the whole thing.
Yeah.
And we've also found out that were-ravens have Tourette's.
That's hilarious.
They were helping us out, but they cut every time they'd say something, they'd end it with, "Bitch! Bitch!"
Joe, you'll like this in the link. If you check the link out, they're telling some of the little tidbits they know. They know the book will contain a large section on setting safe boundaries.
Hey.
Does that make you feel better? Oh,
what does that mean?
Is that like the reissue of Curse of Strahd they did recently?
Oh, yeah. We'll be safe.
So you're going into...
X cards, probably.
Right. If so you're going into... Life. You're going into a domain of dread, right? This is all about dark fantasy, vampires sucking your blood and making you his servant, and you're going to say, we can't talk about that.
And listen to this.
X card.
Listen to this. Fresh take on Vistani. Cultural consultants used. Oh, yeah, baby. Going to be Domains of Dread SJW edition.
Heaven forbid if they culturally appropriate.
Thank you, Watchy, for telling me how to play.
Folks, go back and get the originals. I'm sure you can find them on drive-thru and get a POD.
Yeah.
Yep.
You know, I've got some stuff. I've got you ever seen the 3-volume Van Richten's Monster Hunter's Compendium?
Oh, the old
that's
one.
That's way back, huh?
Was in a folder?
Remember the Van Richten's Guide to Whatever?
Yeah.
They compiled all those.
Nice.
Into, like, you remember the, you know, I have the Encyclopedia Magic. They're kind of like that, and they're 3 volumes.
Oh, I never saw
and
that.
And it's all of those.
Nice.
Yeah.
That's nice.
And after show, I'll show it to you after show. You know, I don't play Ravenloft, but I can always use some advice on undead.
Oh, right. Ravenloft had some sweet stuff.
And somebody gave me the Ravenloft Guide to Transylvania, which is a sweet, sweet read.
Yeah.
You know, the one Ravenloft thing I do like is Mask of the Red Death.
That's an interesting setting. It was a little too modern for my players back in the day. I couldn't get anybody to really play it.
Well, I like
it because
I'm really into like classic horror and Hammer horror.
Hammer
just
films.
Felt that Hammer horror sweet spot right there.
Right.
You know what? I'll say this. My wife played that. The first game I ever ran my wife through, we were dating.
Uh-huh.
I used Mask of the Red Death.
Right.
She was a lady who had escaped the South and was on a riverboat.
Huh.
I brought everybody together on a riverboat, and the main bad guy was a werewolf.
Wow.
And over these 3 nights was turning and killing these wealthy people. And it was really a pretty cool thing. I actually had a guy.
And you're still married?
Can you believe that? Yeah. So connected to this, Beetle and Grimm You know how they have these really cool, super neat boxes? For just a mere $359, you can have the legendary Curse of Strahd.
Pocket change.
Right, where they will give you all these cool maps, which they are cool, a lot of cool stuff. But this is something that bugged me. The guy that does the I don't know if you watched that video, the video that I can link to. The guy that does it gets really excited about finger puppets.
That's where you lost me at.
There's finger puppets in the box. Who wants that? Who wants that?
TSR put hand puppets in the Brocky and Bullwinkle box.
Okay. And the Strahd, little vampire, little werewolf, little.
That'd be hilarious.
Okay. I guess. I don't know, man.
That appeals to my sick and twisted sense of humor.
But wouldn't that? Isn't that a. That'd be a mood killer in a Ravenloft game.
In the right situation, yeah. But it's worth it for a laugh.
Where did the bad vampire touch you? Show me on this finger.
That would be it. I'm sure there's a safety tool for using it just that way.
Oh, man.
Oh. So what did you guys think of The Elusive Shift? John Peterson's book. I thought there were some interesting comments.
I haven't read any of his books.
It looks interesting. I might take a peek.
Because he made a statement. He said, like, when they first started D&D, when Gygax and Arneson were doing it, and even the original White Box, which I can attest to that because I've been reading my PDF of it, they assume you know crap. They assume you know chainmail. They assume you know quite
a bit. That's right. You're right.
And they just start jumping into it. And
It's for war gamers.
And they never explain what role-playing is. And they talk about that's kind of why AD&D – let me give you this quote. Tell me what you think of this, Glenn and Joe. He said, TSR realized that if D&D was to be a viable business model, the completely open, play a dragon if you want mentality or style of play wouldn't lend itself to repeat purchases. The original gamers from OD&D who valued their improvisation were coined grognards, and the young upstarts who were focused on using the rules to become super person were termed munchkins.
Yeah.
And I mentioned Glenn because that's his name, Radio Grognard. That's Old Man Grognard. But the point is,
that's where
you
I
think
got
that, do you think that's why they did it? I mean, does that sound reasonable? That, you know, hey,
it sounds very reasonable.
Because they had no rules early on. It was like, do what you want. Gygax said, play a dragon if you want to.
You know, it's also the war gamer. It was the war gamer mentality, the people who put this out too, because people who are war gamers to me seem like they've been war gamers for a long time. So it's like nothing old is, you know, nothing's new under the sun for them. So if you say, you know, but what do you, if you say that the guy moves three instead of three hexes, the guy moves 3 inches, you're assuming somebody's taking a ruler out and measuring it and all this other stuff. So it's just that war gamer mentality they were appealing to. But then they realized, hey, we want a wider audience so we can make more money.
Well, yeah, and you can't blame them for that. I can't blame them.
Not at all. I think they did the right thing, you know, starting with the home set.
And it seemed like, too, I guess war gamers, it kind of the fluff that's around the story, that's probably why they said, do whatever you want. It doesn't matter. We have the rules. We need to do whatever we're doing. And you can make your fluff whatever you want. Hey, maybe that was the original idea.
You leave the door open for that, and people are just going to run with it.
Yep.
Yeah.
Which is fine. Which,
yeah.
They did. They literally did. Yeah. Tunnels and trolls, which is, right?
And we're the better for it.
Yeah, agree. Okay. 100%. 100%.
I think I've read a few articles on this subject, and I think about it a lot. You don't need a lot of rules when you are doing an NPC interaction, except possibly if you're wanting to get one over on them. But if you're just, you know, receiving information, or you're having a play session, we're in town gathering supplies and stuff like that, you really don't need a whole lot of rules for that. And I mean, you need rules to tell you what happens when you walk into the cave bear's cave and you have to throw down. You need
You know, I've got a lot on Radio Grognard. I talk a lot about rules that are there, that rules that you use to simplify games and things like that. I did one episode, I don't know if you've heard it or not, about, I call it Glenn's D&D game. It meant down and dirty. And I put it on a large index card. And I said, okay, let's do that. I got the 6 stats. Okay, this what's, and then I go back to benchmarks. benchmarks to me are the heart, one of my heart and souls of my game. You got to know, if you know what's average, you can figure out what's not average, above or below. If you have, say, stats for an average person, then all I have to do when I write up my write-ups for NPCs, all I have to do is write up the stats that are different from the norm. So right. I write, he has a strength of 18, or he has an intelligence of 6.
Yeah, you don't have to write every little thing down about him.
Right, which makes the stat blocks a lot simpler, and it's easier to ad lib that way. You can even do that with monsters,
right,
to a certain extent. You know, there's a little bit more variation.
Well, but,
Randy
should share with you he came up with, I don't want to speak too much for you, dude, but you came up with a table of armor class, damage, and whatnot for when we were long in the tooth with
Pathfinder.
With
all the extra books and crap.
You just were like, it's the stat blocks in Pathfinder were ridiculous.
Yeah. And players were like playing all these combos, Glenn, and so it was hard to gauge. And I just kind of and it's funny because I'm a math teacher at a community college. I can do the math, but I didn't choose to. I use my gut. I've been playing for 30, 40 years, and I was like, you know what? If you want an easy encounter, make monsters have these stats. And I just did 8-10.
I love some of the clones and stuff who get it.
Yeah.
Like Swords and Wizardry, one saving throw.
I actually like that a lot.
I love that. And then you just do variants depending on what the class is.
Make your save. Where is it? Yeah. Right there.
I like the three that third edition went to because that made sense to me.
Yeah, it does.
Fifth edition came up with six stats. I was
this
like,
kind of it's Astonishing Swordsman splits the difference on that.
Oh, okay.
They give you a fighting ability, a casting ability, and one save. But they give you five categories, and all you do is if you're a certain class, you get a +2 in this save and a +2 in this save.
Oh,
that
I
kind
see.
Of thing. Right. So all you have to do is just remember the one save and remember your pluses, and you're good.
Yeah, that's the same thing. That makes sense. And having a bunch of different things to roll against the old five was good to go to the three, and then they went way, jumped the shark with six. I just thought it was dumb.
The stats are
Your stats are your saves.
Being older,
get charisma save. That's dumb.
Yeah. Being older now, I'm a fan of. I love the idea of the single saving throw, but I'm kind of with Joe. I do think as a good balancing act, fortitude, reflex, will is pretty simple. Definitely, it covers. Now, whether you implement it like third edition or not, Glenn, I'm not saying that. I think the idea of something where you got to have high stamina, a strong force of will, and an ability to dodge. What are the things are there really?
Okay, now let me contradict myself.
Go ahead. I do too.
There are some things in this game that I like to do because of tradition. And the five saves I do have a soft spot in my heart for.
AD&D.
AD&D. It took me a long time to get on the ascending armor class train. But my sense of laziness finally won out because I know Thaco. Thaco is not hard.
No, it's not.
Once I got in my head how I can convert ascending to descending or vice versa, let's go.
Yeah.
Right. And doing ascending armor classes. There's a problem with large numbers. Mm-hmm. And when in third edition, you went to ascending and having a bunch of other things that can add to your to hit roll, you just started
that
having big numbers.
I still don't understand.
Why do I have to
add this to hit roll, which I didn't have in first edition?
Right.
All of a sudden, I need another number to help me hit.
Right.
Well, aside from the pluses and minuses the DM might give you or whatever.
Well, you did have your base Thaco to start out with based on your level.
Right.
So, Glenn, believe it or not, it's in there. It just wasn't presented to you the same way. So your base to hit is actually, I'm not saying it's the same number, but mathematically they're doing the same thing, because right. they're giving you, a fighter has a THACO of 10 or a 20. A wizard has a 10, let's say. A wizard has a THACO of 18. That's kind of like saying dude's got plus 10, other dude's got plus 2 to hit.
Well, yeah, I can understand that. It's just that I'm thinking back even before THACO. They saw THACO
with the chart.
The chart, it's like, this is it. This is what we got. This is all we have.
And then there are lots of repeating numbers in the charts.
Yeah, well, they said that about THACO. There's a lot of repeating 20s. Yeah, so what?
Yeah.
I thought the charts were.
Are you not happy with getting a 20? What's wrong with you?
Am I not? Are you not entertained?
And yes. Then there was also the other end where it was the negative numbers in the charts where you would get a bonus to damage. Yeah.
Right. Mm. But I remember the days where you say, oh, I have a negative 3. You're going, whoa.
Yeah. Yeah, it was boss.
Well, you are one badass guy.
Yeah. Right?
Well.
All right. Shall we move on to the main topic, Joe?
Main topic, CR and predictability in RPGs.
More visual.
This has been sitting in my little noodle brain for a while now. It's the mile high view for me is there's been a tendency since third edition, and apparently after reading some of these articles, it's kind of been in the background in previous editions about balance and having encounters not be too awfully tough for the PCs, which
within a certain level of challenge.
Within a certain level of challenge, and you know. Looking back across my long, illustrious career of gaming, I don't recognize that as being a thing.
It wasn't before, a thing. In fact,
third edition.
In fact, you probably hear my eyes rolling as you were talking about it.
Because, and that's why I've been talking about predictability. When you bring in that factor, and I think it's even more pronounced in fifth edition, you have a smaller variance in experience at the table. You never have to really run. Mm-hmm. And in 13th
age. If you do, your DM's being unfair.
Sure. And in 13th age, and this isn't really necessarily a knock. It might be the way the game is geared. In 13th age, I don't know if you're familiar with that too much, Glenn.
No, I'm not.
It's really structured heavily. To the point that you know your abilities are really only targeted toward the important encounters, and that's the only ones you're having.
Yeah.
This is important to the game. There's no random encounters or anything like that. And so you know that the encounter you're facing is geared to you so that you shouldn't really fear anything.
Though at the same time, they talk out of both sides of their face. We played this game for about 5 years, and they tell the DM, this is how you build a fair encounter. And then they go on to say, but don't be fair all the time. Right. So to be fair
don't
to them.
Don't worry, I won't.
Right, exactly. So it's interesting that you say that, Joe, because I think when you mentioned predictability last week, and I wasn't exactly sure until I thought about it, you know, the idea of a CR was not in second edition or first or OD&D.
It wasn't.
I do recall cries of players, and one of them may have been Joe's voice in the background in original D&D. You're going to make us fight a Bodak? We're only third level.
Well, you know, you know when I was running.
I'm not saying they were wrong.
When I was running second edition, I mean, okay, first of all, I don't like CRs. Let's get that out of the way right away. Secondly, I've made my mistakes in the past too. When I was running second edition and they all had freshly minted first level characters, I threw four giant spiders at them, not knowing what I was doing.
Right.
Everybody dies.
One TPK later, we were making more characters.
Yeah, we did that.
And it's like, maybe I should have used two.
Right. If even.
In this discussion, I have, we're not going to go through the articles, but probably Joel put it in the what's called show notes. There's two articles by the Angry GM. One I think is pretty good. They're both fairly long. Angry kind of focuses on a discussion of CRs in relation to 5e. Very cool chart in the second article. And then there's a guy, I don't know his name, but it's at Dungeon of Signs Blogspot. It'll be on there. He talks more about old school, and he kind of focuses more on how CR can create an antagonistic environment. We can talk about that. I don't want to go through those whole articles, but they kind of inspired some of the things that I think I want to ask. Tell me this. Now, Glenn's already clearly stated he doesn't like CR. And I'm leaning that way. I'm not particularly fond of CR.
Not too crazy about target numbers either, but that's another
interesting
story.
Okay,
that's
cool.
Another story.
So let me pose this to you, gentlemen. With CRs in mind, when there's a challenge rating and it's listed in the game, whether you use it or not, as a mechanic, can you tell me, first of all, it might be harder for Glenn, what do you think are advantages to having a CR in an RPG game when you have challenge ratings for monsters that can tell you how tough they are compared to four characters?
Okay. I can see an advantage, but I can also see abuse. Mm-hmm. What I see, because like, I'm going to tell you about Swords of Wizardry has a monster rating for all their monsters.
Oh, okay. There you go.
Which makes it a little easier to figure out, you know, matching things up. But I can see the advantage in the same way as challenge ratings. But okay. People, it just seems, well, people are people. I'm trying to say this without knocking a lot of people. I just find it disconcerting that people will, and I learned this when I was playing Champions, people will follow the these kind of rules to the letter and not budge.
Yeah.
Because I assume they're probably insecure in their GMing.
Or so they'll say, this is the CR. It says it right here. It's
exactly.
Should be a good challenge for you. But I can't help that you had a TPK.
Yeah. Exactly.
That kind of thing.
Hmm. Yeah.
And you get the other side to be the take the that's the take that's the one side. That's the other side. Players be like, dude, why are you throwing a CR6 at us from second level?
Yeah.
And not knowing and the DM is this
say,
is a sick.
Yeah. Oh, I'm sorry. Good. I say, no, dude, sir. How do you know it's a CO6?
I read the monster. I own the monster manual.
Glenn. I'm the GM. I'll make it a 7 if you don't shut up.
That's right not on. Abusive at all.
Right I had on. About 4 more hit dice on there. How do you like them apples?
Pro initiative, bitches.
Yeah.
No. Initiative? What's that? You go last.
No, this is the roll to see who goes. Yeah. Who gets to go after the dragon kills you.
Yeah. Who among you get to go in what order?
Who gets to go to the kitchen and start making their character first?
Right.
Yeah.
No, but truthfully, I think there is something to be made it. In one of those articles, a guy talked about the antagonistic thing. I think the advantage is it gives young DMs at least a loose guideline where they can try to anticipate this.
You're right.
But having said that, the older I get, the more I see the disadvantages because I think expectations change and players get and the whole thing that Glenn pointed to is they go a little crazy with the raw. Well, it says we should not fight more than 4 of these in a day. And it's like,
right.
Oh,
players do that too. They game the whole thing.
Yeah.
I read something on, I don't know, it was Facebook or somewhere else, where the creators stated that CR should only be used for the first like 4 or 5 levels. Mm. And then the GM starts, you know, doing it the way he wants to do it.
Well, you kind of have to because the CR written in 5e is broken after 5 levels.
I can see it being a good tool for
it's like the training wheels.
Yeah, so that was exactly the phrase I was getting ready to use. The training wheels.
Sorry.
For someone who hasn't. Oh, no problem. For someone who hasn't used that system, once you've used that system enough, you should have a good feel. And I know Randy had a good feel. He had a good feel for bringing challenge to our lives.
Hey, the struggle is the glory.
You had to bring your A game. But if you did some kind of weird thing, like I made a character that was all brains, no brawn.
Okay.
And it was a wizard, so that's the way they're supposed to be, but I just made it too much that way. Mm-hmm. And it just didn't work out.
Right. Well, it was very dangerous in 3D before we understood how 3D can get crazy at higher levels. If you make a wizard who has a crappy con, you're dead.
Still need hit points.
You got to have those HPs. If not, you're dog meat.
Right.
Yeah. Okay. Well, what I do the old school stuff. This is how I do it. I look at all the levels of the characters versus the hit dice of what I'm throwing at them and then make the call.
Sure.
So if you have 4 fives, four fifth level characters, that's 20. You'll throw 20. You feel comfortable throwing 20 hit dice of
things. I can throw up to 20
hit dice.
And there's also, I just thought of this. This whole thing makes it difficult when you have a mixed party. It's really hard to have a mixed party.
Maybe.
With CRs and all this so tightly woven in.
Third edition and beyond gets tougher, but Glenn's making a... Because in second edition, it was common. Modules would be like, this is for 5 to 7 characters of level 9 to 12.
Yeah. Right. Yeah, I didn't start reading that until recently. It's like, oh, this is for 2 to 4. 5 characters? What? But yeah, so to me, it's like, you know, total levels versus hit die. Now there is, you know, there's a couple of things you got to think about there. If the monster has special abilities, I would add like half as many hit dice because of that. You throw them up against the beholder, you guys run away. Okay, please. Yeah. Because the hit dice is going to be ridiculous after all the special abilities.
Yeah. And there's when Joe and I were talking about it, we had a 5e episode with our friend Philip, and I mentioned that I had looked at the CR rankings for, because Joe has a character at 13th level, super powerful fighter. Uh-huh. And I said, four 13th level characters, maybe it was four, I don't know how I was gauging it, could be a good fight should be 4 CR 5 monsters. It should actually be a deadly fight according to the chart. But I found 4 Night Hags, and I ran through their hit points and their abilities, and I'm like, 4 13th level characters would kick the living crap out of these Night Hags.
Probably.
Having said that, I found other CR monsters that had really nasty saving throw attacks that would have taken his fighter down just like that, because he'd making two saves around. Right. And I was like, this party would really struggle. So I think trying to do the whole CR thing is almost, to make it a science, I'm not saying it's impossible, but because 13 Days does a good job, and they say 4E did. I'm not arguing because I don't know. But my point is, I think when you go down that road, lies madness. What I mean by mad?
It does.
And by madness, I mean either it's impossible, or if you make it work, it's going to be something you're not going to want to play. Joe would bristle at this little box I would put them in.
I would say, if you can get a hold of a PDF or a POD or whatever, of if you guys have this, of the D&D Rules Cyclopedia.
Got it.
Okay, that chapter that Frank puts in there about balancing encounters, I think is pretty good. It's a little bit more involved than I want to do, but it's a good system. And the fact that you look at all the monsters in there, they put asterisks after names to show you how many special abilities they have.
Oh, that's
which makes
good.
It that's easier not- to figure out how to balance it.
Not all hit dice monsters are created equal.
Eyeball it.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I think... Go ahead.
No. Go ahead.
I was like, third edition, though, the only drawback, as much as, you know, like I said, me and Joe loved it, and I still would probably say it's probably my favorite version of D&D, at least now it is. We'll find out.
Which one?
Third probably is. Having said that, I've seen it. I played it so long, I've seen the warts. And kind of like second, and second's really close.
I don't like it because I actually ran it for a certain amount of time.
Oh, I ran it for years.
I was being stupid. I didn't know it was a bad system. But
teach their own. But my point is, I think the CR system in third didn't really take into account monster abilities, just did kind of hit dice, hit points, armor class. This should work out. Yeah, dude, but he's throwing a disintegrate spell every round. That is not easy. Yeah.
if you think about it, hit dice versus levels, it's asking yourself, an average number of players in that party versus this hit, what percentage of hit dice are they going to be taking away in a fight? The higher, the more.
Yeah.
So that's the kind of thing I'm thinking about when I'm balancing encounters or doing something like that.
Yeah, I think one of the other themes in these articles was the attrition idea.
Yes.
Where no single encounter, the idea isn't, it's not the hardness of it, isn't necessarily will the PCs survive. It's more how much of their resources will be drained. And how many of them could possibly be had in one day, whatever one day is, which is fuzzy these days.
Right.
And the idea isn't to It's the attrition idea, not the this one encounter taken as of just by itself. It's within the scope of a session or a 1 24-hour right. period from the point of view of the players, whenever the powers refresh and all the other stuff.
I hate to use this term because I hear it all, resource management.
Yeah.
Every time I hear it, I think I'm playing Farm Life on the computer.
But I think as a game master, DM, honestly, I don't want my players, though, to get into this mode of, this will take 20% of our resources. This will take 20% of my resources.
Yeah, you don't want that kind of...
Another 20. Thinking. Oh, crap, we're going to fight the dragon. We better go hide. And I want to have days where, like... I mean, Joe, you might remember this fight. This is high level, third edition. Really high level. We're talking close to 20. And I had this fight. I killed Joe's wizard twice in the fight. And he had to be resurrected during the fight. And, the thing was, it was a battle that the book would have said, what are you doing, Randy? This is completely unreasonable. And guess what? They won. Now, it was the day. That's all they wanted for the day. But it was one hell of a fight. And sometimes you could have boom, boom, boom. Other times it's like, well, the dragon's tired of your shit. He's rolling down to town. Roll initiative.
Right.
You know, and it's going to be a hell of a fight. And half the day is going to be fighting and recouping and figuring out what you're going to do next. I think it's fun to keep players on their toes and not follow this 20%, 20%, 20%, 20%.
Really, one of our friends, and I don't know if you heard the episode, that he came up in two of our episodes, where one of our friends, we like playing 13th Age a lot together. He made a comment because I was like, oh, we're talking about random encounters for some reason. He's like, you can't have that in this game.
Yeah,
I might have to use some of my powers on that.
Excuse me, whose game is this again?
Well, we were both
running,
players.
Who's running this game?
Yeah, and I'm like, okay, whatever.
To defend him, though, he's not
right.
Right,
he's from a point of view,
from a mechanical game viewpoint. Dude's very mathematical. Really good. You like the music. He's a good cat. He's not trying to be like, oh, you're cheating me. He's just saying the way the game is set up, that would throw the balance off. Well, it is if all you care about is highlights. Well, if all you care about is the highlights.
Yeah.
I maintain I've had a hard time, as much as I love 13 Days,
I mean,
running a campaign that feels like the characters live there.
Yeah, I eat rules lawyers for breakfast. So, well, actually, I don't want to say I love hate, but I respect rules lawyers because they can be quite handy sometimes.
You would like this dude.
He's handy.
That 12-year champions game, we had one guy named Paul who was a champions encyclopedia.
Right.
And I remember my friend Mark used to keep him right next to him at the table. And he'd say, he's in the middle of battle and stuff. He'd say, will you look that up? He'll look at him. Okay, blah, blah, blah. Or if he knows it off the top of his head, he'll tell him. But the guy, the rules lawyer guy, Paul, understood that Mark is the final authority on this.
And so does this guy.
He would suggest, you know.
I would say his argument was a theory craft. Would you say that, Joe?
It was a theory
statement, because I played a lot with this guy, and I love having him at my table. He's a good dude. He knows the games. He's fun to play with. So he's not trying to cheese anything. He's just I think some people are looking for a more gamey experience at the table. I don't know if that makes sense, where it's more, I want a fair challenge, and I want it to be fair.
Hey, nothing wrong with that.
I think they want predictable.
They do.
I don't know.
No, me neither.
I think the perfect game is a combination of role playing and dice chucking.
Right. Right.
You know. That brings up a good point, though, Glenn. Do you want, if you're DMing, and I think I know the answer. I could be wrong. Do you like the idea of predictability? Do you want your players to know, hey, I can be sure that Glenn is not going to give us something we can't handle?
Oh, yeah, I like it. Then I can throw him for a loop.
Okay, so really, no. Yeah, gotcha.
There's nothing wrong with a certain amount of predictability. It makes the game move fast.
Sure. Do you want to know that when your character is walking across the ground, he's not going to suddenly fly up into the air for no reason. So some, like, the laws of physics should be familiar and things like that.
I don't want to make my players paranoid is the bottom line.
I've been guilty of that because I know that can happen. In that Seven Spheres game I referenced, my players may not call it paranoid, but they had to come every day.
You always have that one guy, no matter what character, he always has a 10-foot pole.
Oh.
Then they're getting a little paranoid.
Yeah, or if they're preparing and combing through the rule books for every advantage they can get, because they know I'm bringing something crazy.
Gage is in love with pole arms.
Okay.
I don't see why, but he gives a couple of good valid things. One, he likes the reach.
Yep.
Because he can stand a square away and reach somebody and get them. At the same time, he can use it like a 10-foot pole and try stuff out. And my argument is always, yeah, but you're going to be in a dungeon someday where there's not 10-foot ceilings. You're going to be carrying it like this, and there's no place
wide,
to...
Or a 10-foot wide hallway.
Yeah.
And I was told by someone recently, there is a 5e loophole where you can use a pole arm, and there's a feat you can take that stops the movement of someone coming within your reach.
Uh-huh.
And so they're out of your reach, but you can attack them.
That's probably what he does.
You can keep them at bay there?
Yes. That's pretty cheesy.
Yeah.
But okay.
Because before, in previous editions, the pole arm, you could, a reach weapon like a pole arm, you could attack people at reach at your 10 foot or 15, depending on how big they were, but you couldn't attack them if they were adjacent to you.
Correct. But if you stop their movement, they can't get closer next time because you could do it again.
Yeah, but I'm just saying, in 5th edition, I don't know if that's the rule still.
I don't either. So,
in 3rd edition, I don't know, pole arms weren't... There was a big pole arm article in an old Dragon magazine.
Yep.
Uh-huh.
But pole arms weren't really much of a big thing in previous editions. A lot of them had crappy damage anyway, compared to other weapons.
For what?
But in 3rd edition, it was very specific. They had decent damage, but... You can only attack it that, you know, while they were 10 feet or more away. Once they got within adjacent to you, you couldn't. You had to use a different weapon.
Right.
Yeah. There was an article that I had put on our outline there, and it was a Reddit article.
Yeah.
And they talked about something about in regards to when, what exactly was in the monster manual, a number of monsters shown. And then someone commented that it says if a creature, and I think this might be a quote, I'm not sure, if a creature's entry, I think that's maybe it's a person, if a creature's entry in the monster manual states number appearing as 2 to 20, the DM should not simply roll 2d10. They should choose the amount according to party strength, DM, what he wants the encounter to achieve, and what is sensible to the situation. And so...
Maybe. Well, you know, that's good advice.
Yeah, yeah. I think it is. As a DM, that's the decision he makes. My thought is, though, so let's say that's about the best. I don't remember much advice from Gary in 1E and 2E about balancing encounters. Mm-hmm. So do you think 3E, were there any other games before 3rd edition that ever talked about this idea of encounter balance and challenge rating?
Well,
or even
again,
or?
Once again, basic, go back to Beckme Rule Cyclopedia. He talks about that in there. Has a whole formula for it.
There's a lot of quotes.
Oh, he did.
In, yeah. There was one of those threads, there were a lot of quotes from prior to 3rd edition books on with using the word balance and with encounters and stuff like that.
Right.
So the idea, like I was saying earlier, it was there, but it was more kind of in the background, kind of something that you could pick up on if you read carefully.
Yeah.
But if you skimmed or didn't really read it very much, like we kind of did at the very beginning of our when we first played, we just kind of flew by the seat of our pants for a while.
Jumped to magic items and spells and started playing. That's what we did. We didn't care what the rules said.
Yeah.
You know, it's funny. Glenn mentions the Rule Cyclopedia again. That's actually one of my notes here. In that article, it talked about balancing encounters compared to total party level against individual adjusted hit dice. That was a sort of a challenge level in the Rule Cyclopedia. Yep. So I guess they were thinking
I like that because I like that because I can eyeball it.
Right.
I really don't want a system, a codified rule system that is actually in a book.
Like a formula.
Yeah, a formula. I don't want a formula because formulas are formulaic.
Yeah.
And that, you know, that's fine for the rank and file, the usual stuff, but you know, you wanna put a little more personality into it. You wanna just I'm not afraid to fly by the seat of my pants. As far as monsters go, there's several times I wrote monsters and I didn't have the book with me. And so, okay, it's just goblins. I know they have X hit dice, like one hit die. And I know they can do whatever damage. I'll just write the damage, whatever the hell they're carrying. This is what they do.
Right.
Type of thing. So I'm used to like eyeballing it and just off the top of my head. I do have the book. I'm not saying I do have the book. I'm trying to show you. I'm not going to go all the way the other side. Who the hell cares? You know, right. just roll something.
Right. Yeah. It's not total DMV.
Total chaos.
I do think there's a beauty to rule systems that are lighter like that, and a lot of OSR systems where it's easier to wing it. In third edition, I played it so much, I was pretty good, but I was always nervous to just wing something.
I'm not going to say encounter balance, but encounter, let's call it encounter setup for the players. I think that it can be a fine art. You know, it's more of an art than a craft.
Well, you don't even just have the hit dice of the players, of the characters. You have the skill of the players to deal with, too.
And also, go ahead.
Yeah, because some players, they can make the most out of what they have on their sheet. And then come up with things you're like, I never thought about that. That's pretty cool.
See, that's something else you got to take into account. You should at least look at their character sheets once, if not hang on to them for a while or get a copy. Because you got to know what kind of power they're packing.
Yeah.
I mean, more than once I have been, and not only me, but Carlos in the Monday game, more than once we've been bushwhacked by the player characters.
Yes.
Where we go, oh, I forgot you had that.
Yeah.
Oh, I forgot you could do that. And to me, that's another reason why I don't like 5th edition. There's so much of, oh, I forgot you could do that. Because there's so much stuff that Angry, the characters can do.
Yeah, Angry makes a good point. He talks about how the CR system is really built for players of an average party group who are very basic, and they want you to set the encounter up so they have to be complete morons to fail. And you really, to do any kind of balancing game, what our setup game, you have to know your characters. You're right, Glenn. I agree. You have to know your
players'
characters.
Teaching role-playing games is like the give a man a fish, you can feed him for a day. Teach him how to fish, you feed him for the rest of his life. It's the same thing. Show them how to do it right. They're going to go. They're going to be all right.
Go ahead.
I'm sorry. No. I'm done.
I'm sorry, Glenn. Back to the wandering monster thing, because Joe made this with our friend who said this. Do you think in general wandering monsters are good, bad, or ugly for a game? That is, one of the quotes was that the appearance of a wandering monster can actually spoil a game by interfering with an orderly expedition. You have to set up an area full of clever tricks and traps, populate it with well-thought-out creature complexes. And they said expectations.
This is a Gygax quote.
Yeah, a Gygax quote. It says, giving clues to the players. And it says that if you if the player's spells have been expended, battered, and they've been battered and wounded, the characters track back to their base. Expectations have been dashed and probably interest too by random chance. And then he follows it up with this. But if the party deserves it.
Oh, that's scary.
Then stick it to them.
I'm not afraid to say that the master is full of crap.
Oh.
And because I love random encounters. But the caveat, if I'm ready for it, if I have the tables and I can ad lib the stats, but if I wrote them up in my prep, even better.
Yeah.
You know, here's a story I like to tell. In this game, the Ghost Ship of the Desert Dunes, when I first ran this from my group, my Monday group, they were trekking through the Diamond Desert, and I rolled on a random encounter table, and I got a camel. And so, okay, and one of the things I like about random encounters is it gets me to think. It gets me to think outside the box. So I said, okay, they're going to come across a wild camel. What's it all about?
What's a wild camel doing?
Because they have like donkeys and camels and stuff. It's a train, you know, it's like a wagon train. They're going trying to find something. And I said, okay, this is a male camel. And the main guy's riding is a female camel. And this other camel's going to go to attack and start to, you know. And so they subdued it. And when they camped for the night, they made a corral for all the camels and donkeys and stuff. And nobody, because they were doing the nasty in the camel pen.
Right.
So what happened was our wizard character went out to the corral, whipped a sleep spell on the male camel, and then one of the other characters castrated it. Fixed it.
That's
and then, he did a heel on there, and it's like, all right, let's all go to sleep. And I thought that was great for role playing. It was great. Oh, come on.
No, it's cool. I'm just thinking, I don't want to be cast. That's fine. I think it's hilarious. But
it's just like fixing an animal, you know?
Yeah, it is. Yeah.
Roger that.
He's spayed. It's like, what are you going to spay him? Okay. Knock yourself out.
Right.
I'll let you do it.
Yeah. So you think Wandering Monsters are fine?
Oh, would they're
you,
fun.
Yeah.
They're
do fun. You think a game? What about 13th Age, Joe? I mean, I feel like they're fine there too, personally.
I think you probably could because, okay, one of the things since Glenn doesn't seem to be too conversant in 13th Age tropes, one of them is the escalation die, and when after the first round of combat. You have a D6, and you advance it to, you have it go to one, and all the PCs have a +1 on all the rolls. And then you advance that throughout the combat every round after that, and at certain levels, the monsters can even take advantage of it or do weird things.
Some monsters can, yeah.
Yeah. And so
I think I just stole a rule.
It's very stealable.
Well, with the problem with the escalation die is once it gets into like the third or fourth round, you've got a plus, now you have +2, +3 on all your rolls on top of your other bonuses.
Yeah.
So you kind of like grit your teeth the first round, but then you're like, okay, made it to the second round, and I got all these bonuses, so I'm cool.
It tends to make you save your big attack for later.
Right.
Nice. Yeah.
So,
but I like the fact that the other side can use it too.
Oh, well, sometimes.
Sometimes. So it's not only certain. It's only certain. It's not very common.
Dragons can.
Yeah. There's a couple of monsters that can use it, and sometimes there are monsters that, well, they may not be able to use the escalation die directly. They might be able to set it back to zero.
Or
keep you from using it something else. So it has some interesting qualities to it, but it also kind of makes the character's life easier.
Yeah.
By making the encounter easier. So, you can probably, even though our friend was not, he was like, oh, I don't think we can do those in this game. I think you can, because all you got to do is wait. You don't necessarily have to use any of your powers or your abilities, and you just roll with it.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Right. And it just makes things tougher sometimes if you don't have your power.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's going to be a nice rule. Judicious use of that would be really nice.
You ought to Google that, the escalation die. I think you'd find it very interesting.
Yeah, 13th Age, you use it in every combat.
Also, what I like to do with the random encounters is they're great for running gags.
Sure.
If you roll good on the first time, like first time they were on a boat in Astonishing Swordsman, they were on a boat, I rolled a barbarian. And so I had this barbarian paddling this log, and his, have you seen my girlfriend or whoever, you know, my woman? He says, no, we haven't. Thank you. And he goes by. So every once in a while, they'll run into this barbarian looking for his woman.
That's funny.
And it just gives a little more personality, and it's role playing. I love it.
Well, I think random encounters can make the world feel like it's doing more than just giving you a dungeon to play in.
Right. Waiting for the players to show up. It's not just
right. Yeah. You want to hear something funny? I, for the longest time, could not justify a dungeon.
Oh, sure. No. Yeah. Why would there be a dungeon? It's kind of silly.
Why would there
They're
be?
Weird.
So I came up with like guidelines and rules I wanted to follow if I made a dungeon, like something like no more than 12 rooms. Or something. I didn't want no mega dungeons because I said, I got to think of a reason why they would have this dungeon. And, you know, 12 rooms seem to be reasonable for practically anything I'm going to use, you know, whether it's a barracks or a wizard's dungeon or whatever it is. Because it just got me one day. It's like, they do all these dungeon crawls. Why are the hell are all these things? Does everybody want to hide from the world?
Right.
You know?
Dungeons can be pretty weird. There's no doubt.
I mean, I like it. Don't get me wrong. I like a good dungeon.
Yeah, me too.
And, you know, but then I started, I have Barrow Maze, I have Under Mountain, both of them, and one and two. And I look at them and go, oh, nice maps. What can I steal? Okay, I'll take that section right there and make that a dungeon type of thing. I could never see myself running something like that.
Yeah, could you imagine? Imagine playing 1 to 20 levels inside Under Mountain. It's possible. You could do it. Holy crap. Yeah.
Well, I mean, you have to have a good story for it.
Yeah, well, I thought it would be because I like Rapanathuk.
Yep.
And, yeah, I got that too.
And I figured you could run that. You just run the different things on the surface. You don't need a dungeon for a lot of it.
I was so surprised at that. I was like, wow, there's a lot of stuff to do. I don't even have to go down the dungeon. Barrow Maze is the same way. You don't have to go into those barrows. My God, there's plenty of like these little nook and cranny tombs and stuff you can find.
Well, there's a lot of temples.
Yeah, a lot of temples too.
There's a lot of temples. Even the areas that are quote unquote dungeons don't necessarily need to be.
Raised to the surface and have it.
Frog God, when they're doing like demo games at conventions and such, they use the Mouth of Doom in there because it's a nice little compact dungeon in Rapanathuk.
Something to be said for the quote unquote five room dungeon. There's something nice.
Oh, I love that. I love that.
Yeah.
In fact, I've got a book called Five. There's one that you're familiar with, John Four and Role Playing Tips?
Yep.
Yeah.
Get his five room dungeons, either PDF or book. He sent me the book.
Oh, cool. Review. I've got his PDF.
I've got a review up on YouTube. Take a look at it. And
all right.
Because it's not just dungeons. It's just like adventures made to use the.
So
there's another plug. There's another plug for a friend of mine. I did Gangbusters. I did Slashing Sword. Okay, fine. I got everybody covered. Except for Midderlands.
Right. Well, is there anything else you guys wanted to say in terms of predictability or challenge rating in their comments or concerns? Because I feel like we've touched on most of the questions I had.
I do what I do. I mean, we made some good points, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah, so, I think the predictability was just something that I've been seeing. I've just been thinking about, especially every time I look at 5th edition and how it's run. It just seems very predictable. 13th Age has gotten that way. And I think there's probably a sentiment out there beyond what our friend was talking about random encounter. What are you talking about?
And I do think CR plays. I think CR, if you're not careful, if you use it as a chain. Mm-hmm. To keep you within a certain distance of whatever you're doing.
Yeah.
If you use it that way, it will lead to predictability.
See, right. I don't care for it because I like to be a little more freewheeling with my games.
Yes. Yeah.
Right. Yeah.
You might have to run from the encounter.
Yeah, so. And that is a real thing in my campaigns. It's guys will. I actually was in. I think it was Matt was running Labyrinth Lord one time, and we ran into a brigade or more of orcs.
Right.
That's the first time I've ever seen an entire party. We said, we're going to leave this alone. And we went somewhere else.
Well, there's the scene in one of the Lord of the Rings movies. I think maybe it was the middle one. When Frodo and Samwise were by themselves and they saw that army going by.
Yeah.
I can't remember the name of it. And there was with the elephants, the whole old
that.
You know.
Haradrim.
Yeah. Right. Those guys. Mm-hmm. Cultural appropriation, sorry.
Sweet.
But that's a random encounter. You didn't have to fight, but pretty I much. Know there you've got some brash people that might like, there's only 50 of them.
Yeah, because random encounters, sometimes stuff just happens. You Captain of the Guard goes by on the road. You say, have you seen this guy? No, we haven't. All right, goodbye.
I've had random encounters hijack the evening in a good way. I mean, in a good way. Joe, it was a bad way once.
Yeah,
but in a good way, where like the players get so into it, I just start weaving it as the story I intended to tell all along.
Right.
And it's really cool for me, and it's really cool for the players.
Right. You know, sometimes I think that as a GM, sometimes I think I've been a player too long to be a good GM. Because I do start thinking of, this is going to, I mean, yes, I don't balance and stuff, but I'm going to go, you know, in the middle of a combat, I'm going, okay, because my outlook of it is, I tell these people, and I get this from champions, I use it for every game now, it's like, okay, the world's a bad place, and, you know, things aren't going your way, but I'm rooting for you.
Right.
That's the whole thing. I want you to win. I'm not going to hold back. I may, you know, once in a while, and I think you're getting a raw deal, but most of the time, I got you win, please, win.
I do want them to win, but I don't want... I hate when a big set piece encounter is a cakewalk. It's very disappointing to me when there's a set piece encounter, and I know it can happen, and I'm willing to let it happen.
For it and everything. You tried to make it as exciting and as tough as possible, and then they just go,
yeah,
I forgot you could do that.
Joe goes, create pit.
Yeah.
Oh, man, what the heck? Screw this encounter.
You know, All right.
How about we move on to the Cabin Con moment then here?
Cabin Con moment.
Yeah, so Glenn's doesn't know that much about Cabin Con, but we told him a little bit beforehand. We get together every year with our buddies and kind of, we call it Cabin Con, but it's just a weekend, an excuse to hang out with your friends, play games, roll some dice.
Fantastic.
And I wanted to connect this. We always have a Cabin Con moment on the podcast. And CR and encounter building was a thing that I think we kind of did in the old Elysium game. It was a shared world game, Glenn. And it was good at some times. It got bad and it got ugly. Do you think at Cabin Con, and Glenn can chime in here, at any real con, do you think it's vital that you give significant thought to encounter building and challenge rating in a con environment, in a one-shot environment or not?
No.
Nope.
No, I don't give it any more thought than I would if I was running a regular session.
Okay. Yeah.
I mean, I know there's certain things you have to do for convention games. You know, there's certain things you have to keep in mind. You know, like these people are only going to play this one game. It's only for a set amount of time. So you got to do this, that, and the other thing. But in counterbalance, I just go about my business and do the usual.
Yeah, I think with a con game, I've never ran at a regular convention, just at the Cabin Con. Mm-hmm. And my thinking has always been, make it fun and exciting. You don't worry about really anything else. That you don't worry more about anything else.
Because you can't screw things up. If you accidentally give a +5 sword out at a con game, who cares?
Who cares?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Unless it's for persistent characters that exist outside of con, and then it's a problem.
You did what?
Yeah. Well, Joe's 13th level character got a Vorpal in 5e, and I don't know if you know this, but a Vorpal is insanely powerful
for that level character.
Yeah. So he's kind of Butch the Badass, but that's all right.
He's a glass cannon, though. A first level wizard with a charm person, and he's done.
True, because his save's not great.
+2, that's all he has.
You know, I know Gage doesn't want to admit it, but I still think he's a bit of a munchkin because he will want... He always feels like he has to play the paladin or the guy. He's the front line. He always has to be the front line guy. He has to have the best armor and everything because his idea is I'm protecting the party.
Yeah.
So he's the first thing he will ask for is like field plate and things like that. I said, okay, fine. In Astonishing Swordsman, they have a magic item called the Ring of the Hyperborean Kings. And he played a Hyperborean paladin. Mm. And he thought it was his birthright. It was his destiny to have that ring.
Cool.
Finally gave it. And he only used it for 2 levels because then we ended. But the point
is... You reach level 12. It was over.
He got level 10. But he was like... Yeah, it's so funny. Carlos was playing what they call a purloiner. That's a thief's cup subclass. Yeah. It's a thief cleric.
Oh.
Usually a cleric of like a trickster god and stuff.
Sure.
And he says he liked the idea that I could bless somebody with one hand and pick their pocket with the other. And he,
you know, my son, thank you for the donation.
Yeah. he made it a point to have Gage be his butt monkey for everything. He would do stuff like Gage Gawk walks into a town. He goes to an armor. How much for field plate? I can have it custom made for you in X amount of days. You know, and then they go off and do something back. And then Carlos, like later that day or night, would come back and offer to buy it at a little higher price just so he can sell it to Gage at an even higher price.
Well, Gage is young, right? He's still in high school, right? Is Gage still
high school? But he feels like he has to have – he likes the Hyperborean Kings because what you can do is you can summon an elemental with it.
Ooh, powerful.
Yeah, and it's like, okay, we can really get through this stuff now. I got to admire him because he does think of the party.
Oh, yeah. I was going to say, that's a pretty good quality right there. He's worried about protecting others, so I'm okay with that.
Yeah, and he always role plays.
Yeah.
He always role plays. He's not saying much in this latest game because he's playing a Warforged Artificer.
Okay.
But when he was playing like the Paladin and I don't know if you know, Astonishing Swordsman, Sorcerers of Hyperborea, there are no humanoids. It's all human.
All humans.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Yeah.
But there's like 26 classes of human and different races of human, like Amazons and Hyperboreans and Ixians and
regional folks. Yeah.
Yeah. So he played a Hyperborean, and he read in there that the Hyperboreans are real snobs. The only people they give any real respect to are other Hyperboreans or Atlanteans, because they respect what they were because they had a high society and all this advanced stuff that got crumbled, millennia ago. And so he played that to the hilt. He would talk down to people. He would help them and stuff, but all the other characters are inferior. He met another Hyperborean Paladin in one of my games, and it's like, oh, they were thick as thieves, man.
Right.
But he always loves to roll. I love a player like that.
Absolutely. That's what can balance the ones that, like, I like Crunch, and I like playing characters that eventually get powerful, but I also play them. They are in the forefront. They mix it up with the they don't hang back and just let everybody else do the heavy lifting.
Right.
I play characters that like to get into it.
Yeah.
And he's pretty smart. He's pretty smart on the battlefield, though.
Too. Yeah. Joe definitely, I can tell you, as his DM for many years, he definitely likes to engage what's going on. He doesn't pussyfoot around, as they say.
I gotta play with you guys.
You do. Play with you guys. 100%. But for our last little segment here, then, this is more of a question. And Glenn, can, as a guy that's not doing it, we're thinking about, we've been tinkering with the idea of our own little game. Do you think we should at least pay lip service to a CR encounter building type thing? Should it be super loose, like a Gygax sort of just this suggestion, or should we consider a real CR table?
I think loose with examples, because I think what all of these systems don't do, or a lot of times, or at least the early ones, they tell you this is how you do it, but they don't show you except in a published module, and you're if we have a DM section in our book, then that we publish, we're like, we should. This is a loosey-goosey method that you can use. And then here are some examples using
it.
Right. And that would be, I think.
See, that was the problem with first edition of Mutants and Masterminds. Because it showed you how to do it, but it didn't give you hardly any examples. And when I was on their message board, the Atomic Think Tank, and Steve, who wrote the game, was on there a lot. I bombarded him with questions on how this works, how that works. Second edition came out. He made sure there were a lot of examples.
Very cool.
And I think a lot of these publishers probably don't do that because of time and space requirements for publishing.
Could be. Well, I also feel that, a CR system can be fine, but one thing that second edition taught me is the value of options. Things like that, you should have a big old banner saying, this is optional.
Right.
Yeah. I think that's important.
To your discretion.
Yeah. And Swords and Wizardry. Yeah, I read Swords and Wizardry White Box, which I have a PDF of. And I was just, that really struck home because he kept saying that. Whoever wrote that was like, hey, if this is how Baylor's work in your world, roll them like this. If not, do something else. This is how we do it. Constantly through the book. And that something about that really struck at a kind of nostalgic thing. I really like the whole openness thing of you choose your own path.
Right.
Yeah. Glenn, it's been awesome, dude. Thanks for coming on.
This has been fun. This has been a lot of fun.
I've loved having you, man. It's great.
Man.
We look very happy to have you here.
Finally, someone that speaks English.
Yeah. All right, Joseph, you want to plug it up here?
Yes. So if you'd like to support our show, please check out our website at www.biggestgeekestpodcast.com/support. Any contribution is appreciated, and we thank you for your consideration. Please share the
podcast. Thank you for your support.
Yes. Please share. The thing that we right now value the most is sharing it with your friends.
Yeah.
Getting the word out. Let people know that we are on the, on the interwebs.
Yes, we are.
We used to be on the air, but that's not really, that's not technically correct.
Oh, you can fudge it.
Fudge it. And I guess with satellite dishes, that's technically in the air.
It is, but, technically.
Sharing it is great. If you have questions or comments, our email is questions@biggestgeekestpodcast.com. And there are a few podcasts we'd like to make shout-outs to because we like to listen to them all the time. Number one, we'll change up the order today.
Absolutely.
Radio Grognard with our guest today, Glenn. Also, Red Dice Diaries with John Allen Large and his wife, Hannah.
All right. Tell the Manticore.
Tell the Manticore, which is a unique, really cool podcast, dramatized, quasi actual play kind of thing. Tavern Chat with Eric Tenkar.
Oh yeah,
and
We
added one. Nerds RPG Variety Podcast with Jason, not Jason Hobbs.
With Jason,
not my cousin Jason. At least not yet.
Yeah. Really, so, mention his first name. And don't forget Big John Allen Large's The Red Dice Diaries.
Oh, yeah. We have that on there. That's our dude.
And anything else that anybody wants to add before we get out of here?
Listen to Thaco's Hammer, I guess.
Yeah, that's good.
Thaco's Hammer.
Go buy more games.
Yeah, play more games.
Do you, Glenn, do you have anything else you'd like to plug anywhere else, any other way to get a hold of you? Or
of course, Gangbusters BX. I always like to plug that. Astonishing Swordsman and Sorcerers of Hyperborea by Northwind Adventures. Mm-hmm. And that's all I could think of on my mind right now. Don't play 5e. Anyway, just saw I sneak that in there.
Oh, dude, yeah.
That's fine. All right. Well, this is Joe.
And I'm Randy.
And remember, if you can't be big like us, then be geeks like us.
Good night, folks.